Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Dan Morin, author of The Caledonian Gambit and frequent panelist and host on the Incomparable Network. And we're going to be discussing Lois McMaster Bujold's, which I have to say slowly, otherwise I never get it out. We're going to be talking about her novel, The Vor Game, which won the 1991 Hugo Award for Best Novel. So Dan, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Seth.
Yeah, it's funny. I actually floated this. I did some searching today on the Incomparable Supergirl Slack because I help out with that. I do the editing for that podcast. Mm-hmm. And I, at some point on there, had pitched the idea of doing the podcast, and Jason Snell had piped in and volunteered to do something. And he also advised me strongly to talk to you about doing one of the Vor Kosigan books. And so, I think I reached out to you probably a year ago and said,
yeah,
you know, save a spot. And you picked the Vor Game, which had some homework with it, which was kind of fun. And I think we'll talk about that at some point, kind of the recommended reading before reading
sure.
this one.
Yeah.
But I'm glad we finally got to do this, and I appreciate you taking the time because I know you're busy.
Oh, I'm delighted. Any excuse to read and talk about Bujold's work, I am there.
Nice. Well, let's talk about you a little bit. Talk about yourself, you know, some of your background. Where would people know you from and all that kind of stuff?
Well, I imagine most people these days probably know me either because I'm a tech journalist, so I write at sixcolors.com with Jason Snell. I also write a weekly column at Macworld, and of course I was a editor at Macworld for many years before that. And probably if not from there, then from my podcasting, which includes The Incomparable and many of its spin-off shows, including Total Party Kill and Inconceivable, the nerdy game show I host.
I yell at my podcast player.
Yeah, that's a frequent alternate title for it. I actually hear that a lot. I also host tech podcasts, Clockwise and The Rebound. So I have a wealth of things out there on the internet, and obviously, you know, Twitter, that kind of stuff too. So I'm around.
Yes, definitely. So how about some of your personal history as a science fiction fan?
Yeah, well, my history as a science fiction fan goes back, I mean, probably about as far as I can remember. I mean, really depending on what you consider science fiction, right? Like anybody who knows me knows that I am a huge Star Wars fan. So that goes back right to my childhood. It's like one of the earliest movies I ever remember seeing. Mm-hmm. And I remember my parents taking me to Return of the Jedi when I was a kid. And basically from the time that I started being able to read, fantasy and science fiction were among my favorite genres. So I started out reading, you know, a variety of things, pretty much anything I could get my hand on at that point. Like obviously a lot of it was sort of your classics and also the entry via like sort of YA stuff. So, a lot of the things I read as a kid were like some fantasy, Edward Eger, I'm thinking of, or Lloyd Alexander, sort of the,
I love his stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Prydain Chronicles.
Yeah.
The Dark is Rising by Susan Cooper. Like those were some of my favorite stuff as a kid. Nice. And I think I came to sci-fi a little bit later, but I'm trying to remember some like the early stuff I read. I can remember reading Foundation on like a school trip. We were on a field trip and I remember bringing that with me on the bus. And I read, you know, just basically anything that I could get my hands on. So I'd always loved speculative fiction. It just resonated well with me. It's funny because so my parents are librarians and I was encouraged to read a lot. That's why I feel like I was so voracious. My dad certainly is not much of a genre fiction reader. My mother, a little bit. She tends to be a mystery reader, but she also is receptive, sort of a light science fiction fantasy reader. I don't think she was as into it as I was, but I have a lot of cousins too who are also big readers, and they pointed me pretty frequently towards science fiction and fantasy that they read. So that's how I sort of absorbed that along the way.
Nice.
And yeah, I mean, and then my friends too, like later when I was in especially middle school and thereon, I had a bunch of friends who were all equally nerdy, and we read, basically we passed our books around and stuff, right? Like people would recommend things and we'd be like, oh yeah, did you read this book? And we just spent all our time talking about like crazy books and movies.
Nice.
And yeah, that was a formative part of my young life.
Cool. Yeah, it's funny. So many of my guests were always voracious readers, and I was not that guy. You know, I had a kind of a young age. Like I read the Prydain Chronicles when I was in grade school. I definitely read the Star Wars Expanded Universe stuff when it came out.
Yeah,
me too. And I read a fair number of Star Trek novels as well.
Oh, yeah. But I read a few of those, too.
Any reading outside that of like science fiction classics, I just did not do. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of stopped reading altogether in middle school, and wasn't until college when I was, you know, studying techo stuff that I started getting back into, you know, wanting to do non-techo reading, which is funny because you'd think science fiction might not be what you'd want in that case, but it's not all hard science fiction. It's not all nuts and bolts. So talking about, Star Wars, I want to recommend to people to check out Not Playing, where you've gone through. I think you've gone through all the Star Wars films with Lex, right?
Yes. Our season 3 of the show was basically all of the Star Wars films up through Last Jedi. We have not done Solo, but it's I was just thinking today we should go back and do that for a special episode at some point. Definitely. So we'll probably do it at some point. Keep your eye out for that.
And and you get to hear Dan die a little inside when Lex doesn't love what Dan loves.
Yeah, it's tough sometimes to have friends with very different opinions on things, but we work through it.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, science fiction or really any media hits you differently at different times of your life. And so if it's something you grew up with, it's... You know, it's not necessarily going to be the same.
It stays with you. It's, yeah. And I know I was just having a conversation, not like 30 seconds before we started the podcast on Twitter. People started talking about the Timothy Zahn Star Wars trilogy. And I was saying, right. Oh, I've read that a bunch and I think it holds up okay. It's been a few years probably since I last read it, but it was a big influence for me as well. So, you know, that definitely does stick with you.
Yep, definitely. So, did you get a chance to tally up your Hugo count?
I did not look at, I sort of skimmed through to see how I was doing. I didn't have all of them, but I can tell you that in the last 10 years of the Hugo Awards for Best Novel, I have only missed, I think I've only missed two. I've missed Among Others and what's the other one? I was just looking at it. Three Body Problem.
Oh, okay.
Everything else. So I've read all of the N.K. Jameson. I read the Ann Leckie, John Scalzi, Connie Willis, China Meville, Neil Gaiman, a bunch of that. And I've read quite a decent amount of the other ones, but I would say, you know, less than half for all of that.
I just realized I didn't come prepared with my number. I think I'm at 26 now, which is pretty good. I started at 12.
Oh, so. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I was going back and trying to see what was the earliest of all the things in there that I've actually read. I think the first Hugo winner I've actually read was Canticle for Leibowitz. So back in
60s,
I read that as again, one of my friends was like, you have to read this book. It's amazing. Yeah. And I honestly, I read it, you know, 20 odd years ago. So I don't remember very much about it.
Well, you can go back and listen to my podcast about it.
All right. Excellent.
Did that one a while back. So, and the Three Body Problem actually. So when you get around to it.
All right. Okay. I'll put them on the list. The list grows ever longer, as you know.
Yes, definitely. So let's talk about your personal history with the Vorkosigan saga and with this book in particular. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, sure. So, all right. I was a junior or senior in college, and my cousin, who is, you know, basically like kind of like, you know, my surrogate. I don't have any siblings. So she was kind of like the closest thing I had to a big sister. And she is also a librarian. It runs in the family.
Wow.
We have like four. And she, well, I was like looking for something to read. And she's like, oh, have you read the Lois McMaster-Bujold series? I'm like, no, I've never even heard of them. And she's like, here, I'm going to give you this book. And the book was The Warrior's Apprentice, which is not the first book in the series, but it is the first book in the series that features the most frequent protagonist, who is Miles Vorkosigan.
Right.
And, you know, I read a lot during college even, but like sort of my fiction reading, you know, I usually had a book going of some sort. And, you know, it was not yet at the point where I started to like, I was still pretty receptive to new stuff. And so I was like, oh, this looks cool. And I started reading and I was immediately hooked. The humor, the characters, the plot, like just the whole world of it, really, it just sucked me in. And, you know, I was like, it went back to her. I was like, this is amazing. Is there more of this? And she's like, yeah, there's like 10, 12 more books. And I was like, yes, I know what I'm reading for the next year. So I just basically like shot through them at that point. And I think I went back after, as I recall, I read The Warrior's Apprentice. And then she's like, well, okay, go back and read the omnibus, which is Cordelia's Honor, which is the first two books in the chronology of the universe, Shards of Honor and Barriar. And I really liked those a lot as well. And then I just sort of tore through the rest of the series. And yeah, since then, basically, as they come out, they always go immediately to the top of my pile.
Right. And I heard, I think there was a recent episode, I can't remember if it was recently read or something on The Incomparable, where you and Jason were talking about a new novella that was in.
Yes. That series was on Recently Read. Very. Yeah. Because it just came, it sort of appeared magically without any prior warning. And we were like, oh, this is amazing. How is it? These things just show up now. This is great.
Nice. So kind of by way of non-spoiler discussion, before we get too much into spoilers, can you give a synopsis of this that's as non-spoilery as possible?
Yeah, I can do that. So basically, Miles Vorkosigan has graduated from his academy, and he's looking to get a great posting because he feels like he did really well. And he kind of ends up with this terrible job and then gets into some trouble over his head, which leads to him being disciplined. As such, he is then sort of dispatched on a mission for the Imperial Security, at which point he stumbles into kind of a series of unfortunate events, I guess, to take a commonly used term,
yes,
which involve mercenaries and spies and missing royalty and all of this various thing, and culminates in sort of this great standoff that just, I don't know. There are parts of the book that just make me laugh out loud.
Yes,
they're really well done that way. So it's a little bit twisty because the plots involve, you know, sort of intrigue and political maneuvering and spy espionage stories all wrapped into one.
Yeah, I was reading a Tor.com post from Joe Walton presenting the Vor game as a good starting point. You know, that it was a decent starting point for reading these books. And I thought, I'm not sure that I'd be able to, I mean, I don't know, since I didn't read it in that context, I don't know how it is as a standalone book. Have you ever met anyone who did that?
I'm trying to think, not off the top of my head, but I could see why, because you don't. So, you know, as a writer, one of these sort of magic phrases that you often hear bandied about when writers are trying to sell their book is it's a standalone book, but with series potential. And I feel like Bujold does a really nice job with the first several books in her series, any of which could be jumping on points. You could jump on in the Vor game. You could jump on the Warrior's Apprentice. You could jump on in Bariar or in Shards of Honor. And you kind of don't really need to have read the earlier books, but you'll definitely get more out of it if you did.
Right.
And so in that sense, because of the fact that Vor game starts with Miles graduating from the academy, it's pretty easy to see that as an easy entree into this world.
Yeah. And I do feel like that opening section with him at Carol Island does give you a good enough sense of him as a character that
right,
it could work as a character introduction.
And in fact, that was originally a short story that was published separately. So it was kind of, I don't know if she backported it into this or what, but like it is sort of a little cohesive episode at the beginning that you could read with and basically know exactly who you're dealing with and see where everything follows from that.
Right. But it just does such a great job of setting up his character and his problem, right, of subordination. Although I guess that's talked to more in that first section than after it.
The line that sticks with me from this book is, it's not my fault. They just keep giving me the wrong orders.
Right, exactly.
Which is, if you want to sum up Miles Vorkosigan in a sentence, that is probably the best one.
So just kind of overall thoughts. I mean, it sounds like you're a big fan of this one. There is some great humor in it. Miles is such a great character. And I mean, The Warrior's Apprentice was, you know, the first one where we really met him, although he was born in an earlier book. And I just love his nerve because he's very well aware of his physical limitations, but he does not let that stop him from having aspirations or from mixing it up and just flying by the seat of his pants. And it's kind of hilarious and very compelling to see how he's able to accomplish the things that he does.
Right. And what I love about him as a character, and I feel very simpatico with him in this way, is that he is a master tactician in that.
Right.
So strategy is kind of like a big picture thing, right? And Miles is rarely in a position to see the big picture. He's kind of just presented with, this is what's happening, and he has to figure out what is the best thing I can do at this, right at this exact moment.
Right.
And some of that is luck, and some of it is that nerve, that sheer nerve to realize, okay, the best play is this, and doesn't really matter how that's going to look. I got to do it.
And there's so no way it's going to work, but I got to do it anyway.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And for me, I know you point out he's a great character. He may be for me, my favorite character in all of literature. I just think he is dynamic and complicated and complex. And I know, I don't think it actually won the Hugo, but if you, I don't know if you've continued with the series.
I have not. I was going to ask you for more reading recommendations.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, they're all great and they build much more after this point. Like they become a little more serial or at least building on the previous ones.
Okay.
So my favorite of all time is Memory. Which was not, did not win the Hugo, but was apparently nominated for the Hugo in 97.
Okay.
And I will say merely that in the back of each of these books, there's always a synopsis of all the book. There's a little chronology with synopses of all the stories. Mm-hmm. And the synopsis for Memory, which is one of my favorite of all time, is simply Miles hits 30, 30 hits back. and it is beautiful and funny and like, just, tragic in some ways, mm-hmm. but also just, it's one of the most affecting books I've ever read. I found a hardcover of it a couple of years ago in a used bookstore. And I was like, am I going to buy this? Of course I'm going to buy this. It's possibly my favorite book of all time. Nice. But yeah, I think for me, the Vore game is a great, it's a great exemplar, especially early on in this series where there are still stakes, but it's a little more light. It's a little more fun. It definitely gets heavier at later parts of the series, but it never really loses the that like wink to it. I think it's always got, and there are some later on that are just, I would classify as out and out comedies.
Okay.
Civil Campaign, Captain Vore Patrol's Alliance. Those are just like almost like a comedy of manners in some way. And there's like intrigue and stuff in it too, but it's just, it's clearly written with an eye towards humor. And I love that she can bounce between genres within right. the series. There are some that are mysteries. There are war stories. There are spy stories. There are romances. Mm-hmm. And like, she manages to do all of it in the framework of this one series, which is incredible.
Well, I really admire just in general in the Vore Kosigan novels that I've read, which are the ones that you recommended, Shards of Honor, Beriar, The Warrior's Apprentice, and The Vore Game. The world building that Bujold does without slogging through world building, just the way, I mean, it just kind of comes organically out of the story that she's telling, right? If telling the background of Beta Colony is important, then she's going to give you that, but through character viewpoint. I can get really frustrated with world building when it's just about describing, you know, a forest or something, where here, you know, there's lots of kind of contrasts between the different worlds, like between the kind of freewheeling Beta Colony and this very rigid feudal Beriar. And it's very compelling just the way the character viewpoints build that world out without it having to be something sloggy.
Right. And she never focuses, like you're saying, it serves the story. This is not a story. This is still a story in which the characters are first and foremost.
Yeah.
The world building supports that. So you aren't going to spend, this is not hard science fiction where you're going to spend a while explaining the mechanics of interstellar travel.
Right.
But you are going to talk about the effects that it has, or like the consequences of it. So like, she's really great when it comes to the social aspects. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, one of the biggest pieces of technology in this entire series are the idea of these uterine replicators,
right?
Essentially like artificial wombs that can be used so that you can raise children without having to have women subject to the dangers of pregnancy, for example.
Sure.
And that makes a huge difference in the way that society is handled, in the way that women are treated, in the way that like women's roles, like all of that makes a huge difference in this entire world. Mm-hmm. And it's not that we have to get into the technology or the gritty details of how that technology works. You just assume, okay, this is what it is. This is what it does.
Right.
You know, and everything sort of follows on from that.
Yeah. Well, if you had to recommend this novel to somebody who, you know, didn't know the series but was a science fiction fan, kind of on what basis would you do that? Like people who are fans of other series, television, movies, books?
Yeah, I think for me, it works best to me as like an adventure novel, I think. Like there's an element of spies and of science fiction, obviously, but like on the whole, you're dealing with kind of this hyper competent, but somewhat undisciplined character. And so, you know, other analogs I can kind of think of from things like the mystery genre for me. And I know, I think this is one of her influences, but the Dorothy Sayers, who is a mystery writer and back in the 20s and 30s and wrote a detective named Lord Peter Wimsey, I believe was one of her impetuses.
Okay.
I recommend her. So mystery, there's an entree for mystery people. There's an element almost of like the Indiana Jones in it, right? Like the sort of devil may care hero. I definitely think if you're into that, Star Wars, obviously, like if you're into that, then especially like Han Solo, Miles definitely has an element of Solo about him, the cockiness, the insubordination. Stuff, I wish there were, you know, honestly, I always flip it around and be like, I wish there was more stuff like this. But if you happened to have read my book, you would definitely like these books. I'll say that.
It's
like,
funny though.
These are way better than my books.
So yeah, your book came out and I read it and very much enjoyed it, but I had not read any Vorkosigan novels yet. And so just in the last few days, I've been rereading The Caledonian Gambit and I can definitely see those influences there. So.
Yeah, I'm not. There are a couple direct homages in there to it. And I will say that that's because this, at the point when I read this in my senior year of high school was right around the time I was first started to think. In fact, I would say directly because of that, I started sketching out the world of the Caledonian Gambit. So, you know, that was 15, 16 years ago. And so for me, I was like, I love these books so much. How do I write something that's like this?
Right.
Clearly isn't this.
Yes, definitely. Well, and on that subject, you have some news about another book coming out, right?
I do. I can finally announce that my next book will be The Bayern Agenda, although I'm told in German it's actually Bayern. So,
yes.
But you know what? I'm going to say The Bayern Agenda because that's how it's pronounced in my head.
And does it mean Bavaria?
It does. Oh. It has a... I drew that word because I liked the sound of it.
Okay,
which is, gotcha. It's a cool looking sounding word. And certainly there's an influence in it, much in the way that in the Caledonian Gambit, Caledonia is simply the Latin word for Scotland.
Okay.
The Latin term for the region that is Scotland. So it has something around those lines where there is a planet in the book named Bayern,
gotcha.
Whatever you would like to call it. And so it doesn't draw quite as heavily from culture as the Caledonian Gambit did in terms of like the resident culture being based on that. Mm-hmm. But there are some links in a little bit. But
okay.
Yeah, it's very much a follow on in the sense of it's set in the same universe and deals with a lot of the same characters.
Nice.
I'll say that.
Cool. I think it's about time to get into spoilers, Dan.
Let's do it.
Okay. So from here on out, just freeform discussion. Anything you want to bring up, we'll talk about. I have a couple things that I've noted down, but you know, listener, if you haven't read any of these books, definitely encourage you to pick them up. Lots of fun. All right, let's do it.
Well, all right. So there's a few things I noticed rereading this, and I gotta say, this was one of the most pleasurable rereading tasks I've had to do in a while, because I just burned through this. I thought like, oh, I got to reread this book, you know, but then I like picked it up and I couldn't put it down. I read it in like 2 or 3 days.
Nice.
And what strikes me, I think from early on is how interesting, and some of this is my perspective because of having read the whole series. And this is one of the few series where characters age and evolve as they go.
Sure.
So in the most recent ones, you know, Miles is in his late 40s, probably.
Okay.
Which is a very different feeling than going back and seeing Miles at 22. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's fascinating to see where these characters came from. Now, Miles at 22, he is, you know, maybe mentally not that different in some
right.
ways, but obviously, you know, he's got his physical limitations. But what I really struck me in this one is the drawing of a lot of these side characters.
Okay.
And in particular, the character of Gregor, who I think is a fascinating character that could have he appears a little bit in the earlier books.
Right.
But you don't really get a sense of him. And it's interesting to see how Bujold investigates that character here and really fleshes him out, because he could have easily just been this benevolent leader. You know, very sort of very masked, very like in control of his emotions, but we really see him as a character here.
Mm-hmm.
And he is kind of the one that embroils Miles in some of this stuff.
Yes.
As they go along. And I found it fascinating that it, you know, in some ways he is, he's really presented as if not quite a counterpoint to Miles, like at least you know, a parallel track, right? Like Gregor is presented as Ivan is often used in these books too, as kind of where Miles would be if he had not encountered, you know, be basically been subject to this gas attack.
Right.
Well, Cordelia was pregnant with him. And so we always measure Miles up to these other characters, or at least Miles in his own mind measures himself up
right.
to Ivan and Gregor. And seeing a situation where, of course, Miles, who starts out this book very unhappy because he has ended up with this terrible assignment, and how he is drawn into having to essentially overcome that and deal with the fact that he, you know, Gregor, who is also very unhappy with his situation, essentially ends up needing his saving, which requires Miles to change his mindset, right?
Yes.
Like change his way of doing things to save his friend and his liege lord, essentially.
Right. Well, and Gregor gets to change through that as well, right? Because he's yes. running from his role. And Miles is in a sense as well, right? Where he wants his, he wants his military life. And I guess he kind of wants to recapitulate his father's life in a lot of ways.
Exactly.
And fill those shoes.
Yeah. So much of Miles's personality is bound up in both his father and his grandfather.
Right.
And how successful they were in their military careers. And of course, he wants nothing more to follow in their footsteps, even despite his challenges that will make that very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. And so what's fascinating about this book too, for both of those characters, Miles and Gregor, is it's pretty much both about them finding their place. Miles doesn't want to go work at, you know, IMPSEC.
Right.
But it turns out that, you know, that becomes the perfect place for him. Mm-hmm. It is exactly where he needs to be. And so even it's kind of, you know, it's Rolling Stones. You don't always get what you want, but sometimes you get what you need. And for Miles, it's finding this career in Imperial security because, you know, we know, and like, this is the thing that's always hilarious for me to go back and reread this is like, you know, after the events of The Warrior's Apprentice, you look at it and you go like, of course this is what he should be doing, right? Like it's so much easier to be on the outside and be like, come on, dude, this makes perfect sense. And he's so set on what he thinks is the path that he has to take.
Right.
That he's kind of blinded himself to everything else.
It's funny, both The Warrior's Apprentice and this book, as I was reading the beginning section of it, I had a picture in my head of where the book might go. And then it turned left, you know, and went a completely different direction. And Miles gets swept into something, right? In both cases, in The Warrior's Apprentice, you know, he gets swept into this situation where he's like, well, I got to bluff my way through this. And then create something that then comes back in this one and sweeps him back in. And where he has to switch between being, you know, just humble Miles and Vorlord Miles and Admiral Naismith, you know, just one after the other. I liked it at some point, the antagonist, what is her name? Begins with a C.
Cavillo.
She says, how many people are you exactly?
Yes. Right.
Which I really like.
Quite a few. I'll take issue with you saying humble Miles, because if there's one thing about Miles, he's never humble.
Agreed. Definitely not. He definitely has an outsized opinion of himself. But it's, it's not
earned.
It is earned, right?
Yeah. There are so many things in here that are so complex, because the plot really does start to spin up into all these circles. And it is, to me, impressive as a writer watching her try to juggle all these different plots, right? Like, because not only do we have him trying to rescue Gregor, and do we have him running this op essentially, and there's a war going on, or like a war, potential war in the offing. But we also even like fold in this whole episode with him at the beginning, on Kirill Island, ends up coming back around at the end when the general Metsov shows up in league with the villain. And it's just it's so deftly tied off, because at that point, you know, it's almost like that was a different book. And you got here and you're like, wait a second. Like, I forgot that person was there, but I guess this makes sense.
When I first started kind of doing the homework here, I found out that my library here in Oregon has digital audiobooks of almost all of the series. And so I picked up Shards of Honor and Beriar and The Warrior's Apprentice. And then there's The Vorgan. I'm like, I should save that. I'll read it in print, you know, right before I talk to Dan. And then I thought, nope, I'm just going to listen to the audiobook because I want to know what happens. And so I was coming back to it this time, reading it in print. And I remembered that somebody had tried to put Miles out in airlock. And I just assumed it was Metsov. but it's a different character. So,
right.
So not only does he piss off the general, but there's somebody else who he was, you know, not completely unfriendly with, who decides to chuck him out an airlock because of how gifted he is at persuasion and he doesn't want him around.
Right, right. In fact, they have a whole bit about don't listen to anything he says because he'll just start twisting the word. Yeah, like, and it's interesting to me too, right? Because the whole funny dynamic of Miles in the first couple of books is that, of course, he is this lowly cadet slash ensign.
Right.
And somehow he's parlayed this into becoming, in his secret life, an admiral.
Right.
And it's as though, you know, and that's not good enough for him, right? Because it's not real. It's not genuine.
Sure.
It's even though it's something he has achieved,
he's playing a part.
It's not in the right. It's not in the context of the thing that he values, right? Like, even though his father is an admiral and he's an quote unquote admiral, right, like he realizes it feels hollow to him because he hasn't earned it. And so watching this dynamic of Miles being incredibly successful at things and yet still feeling like he doesn't measure up, you know, it's essentially imposter syndrome, right?
Right.
Like, he, even though he has achieved all these amazing feats that everyone's like, how the heck did you get them? He stops a war, he builds a mercenary fleet. Mm-hmm. None of that is quite enough for himself.
Right.
He wants a real, what he thinks of as a real role, you know, being an officer, captaining a ship, etc. Mm-hmm.
It's funny the first time when I was listening to the Vore game, and he's in that beginning section where he's on Kirill Island and he makes the mistake of tethering his shelter tent kind of thing to the scat cat, right? To the big piece of machinery. And it's basically sunk in a sinkhole. I'm from Alaska. I'm from Anchorage. And so when he woke up and it said it was dark, I thought it shouldn't be dark there in the summer. And then, you know, he comes to that realization as well. For some reason that made me really identify with him, because there was a time in college where I was working graveyard shift. And so, because I had gotten off work at 8 a.m. and I had hung out with some friends for a while and then kind of took a nap before heading back to work again. And I woke up and it's July in Anchorage and it should be broad daylight outside. And it's completely pitch black and it looks like it's snowing. And what had happened was Mount Spur had erupted and showered, you know, hundreds of miles away, but showered the city with like 3 inches of ash. And I woke up and I'm kind of like, how long did I sleep exactly? so that really reminded me of kind of what happened to Miles. I were like, this, something is not right about this.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and it's, you know, Miles makes a lot of mistakes.
Yes.
He usually recovers from them pretty well. But one of his, you know, one of the things I enjoy about him as a character is that it really takes that truism to heart, that it's like, it's not about, you know, how you fall down. It's about how you get back up again, because he's constantly, you know, slightly misjudging his situation, mm-hmm. And getting thrown into hot water and then having to basically figure out, okay, how do I get out of this?
So, yes.
You know, we mentioned the scene where he has to get out of being thrown out of an airlock. There's a number of scenes where there's a scene where he gets drugged at one point too, doesn't he? I'm trying to remember. I think there's a, she gives him a drink. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember. Yeah, it's been a couple weeks since I read it, so I'm trying to pull out the details of my.
See, I'm getting brain mixed up with the Caledonian Gambit because Brody gets drugged.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, let's not look too closely at that. But what I enjoy also about this is just sort of the watching everybody caught up in his orbit.
Right.
Like, you know, Miles as a character exerts a gravitational pull, mm-hmm. in that as soon as he gets into the playing field, all these other characters are reacting to him. So, you know, we have that scene where he's spotted by one of the Dindari Marines, mm-hmm. and he's like, oh crap, like, you know, they're gonna know I'm back, and now this is gonna become a whole thing. So he's got to try to keep the guy quiet,
right? Because he was only supposed to bust out that personality when it became necessary, right? And so he was kind of blown around.
Right, right. And we have his fantastic, a small role, but I really enjoy Captain Ungari, who is supposed to be his boss, mm-hmm. And who is kind of, I kind of feel like getting the wrong end of a bull or something, right?
Right.
Like, you know, this guy's thinking I can lead him by his tail, and all of a sudden he realizes, uh-oh, I'm pointing him in the wrong direction.
Yes.
And, you know, things don't quite work out for Captain. I mean, in the end, things are okay for Captain Ungari, but like, he's yet another victim of Miles' insubordination issues.
Right. Yes. I like the way Ilion described him. You know, you're a loose cannon, just firing in all directions.
Yep. Yeah. Well, and Simon Illion is one of my favorite characters
yes.
in this entire series. He is delightful. Another reason you should get to Memory, because Memory involves Illion quite a bit.
Cool.
And he is one of the best of fleshing out him as a character. She does this very well with all these characters who she introduces as sort of side characters, but who end up having these very rich lives on their own. Ivan's another good example. You know, he gets a book of his own later on. Mm-hmm. And so her characterization is probably my favorite thing about all of these novels, because she draws these people who are just extremely realistic. Right. And I absolutely love the scene in here. We don't get a lot of Ivan in this one, which is unfortunate, but the scenes we do get with him are pretty fantastic, including my personal favorite where, you know, Miles calls him so he can get Metzoff's classified records.
Right.
And he's like, oh, you can't do it. It's too secure. And he's like, well, what if you just point your camera at this right. secure display?
Yep.
And of course, then later on, he's pointing that out to Illion, like, oh, you kind of got a security hole here. And it's a really dumb one.
Yep. But that's what a lot of them are like, actually. So
yes, right. Exactly. Which is why I laugh at it, because, of course, thinking today, this happens all the time where people are like, we built this super secure system. And it's like, well, but yeah, what if you do this really stupid thing to bypass
it? Yeah. What if
it's
you like, come in sideways here? So
yeah, I didn't think about that. No, yep. You did not.
Well, the other thing I like about Miles is, and this is kind of, it's a thing that comes into several of the books, where Beriar is this feudalistic society, right? And you have, and I can't get behind feudalism or classism of any kind, mm-hmm. really. The idea that somehow someone's blood makes them more noble than someone else.
Sure, sure.
It's just the American in me, I guess, that just can't get behind that. And yet, Bujold does a really good job, I think, of showing, yeah, there's some privilege that comes along with that, but there's also a lot of responsibility.
Sure.
And that's what's crushing Gregor, right? In this book.
Absolutely. Yeah, the whole Vor blood thing is a really interesting exploration of, because you're totally right. Like, and you would think, what is interesting about the dynamic here is, of course, that you would think that in the future we would have passed by all that, right? Like that would have been fallen by the wayside. But of course, because of Barriar's circumstances where it was isolated for a long time, mm-hmm. it's sort of developed this class of society. But, and this comes out, as you said, in a lot of the other books too, you know, Miles's responsibility as a member of this caste and as a person who has other people dependent on him, you know, really, it goes a long way towards developing his sense of honor, his sense of personal responsibility, because without that, you know, you could just have a character who felt very detached. Mm-hmm. But it grounds him. And, right. and I think it's an important part of his character in that way.
Yeah. And there's a couple critical moments where he could have just stepped away, right? Like when there's right. the standoff in the snow at Kirill Island, you know, he was dismissed. He could have just gone inside
yes.
and just gone, okay, they'll work it out. But he put himself into that. And then as a consequence of that, in order to protect the men who were in trouble, you know, he was able to use Vor privilege to kind of get those charges quashed, but at the cost of his own career. And that was a very noble thing to do.
Right. I mean, he's nothing if not self-sacrificing in a lot of situations.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a great example of how he's willing to throw himself into harm's way in order to protect the, you know, well, it's for principle. And that's, you know, that's what makes him a hero at the end of the day, and a character that is likable, mm-hmm. right? Like, because he does these things, he's not, you know, even though he knows, like, he's not physically the strongest or physically the most capable, he uses every tool at his disposal to get his advantage.
Yeah. I'm starting to run out of topics to talk about. I mean, I'm sure there's any number of other things that we could discuss. And you had mentioned kind of his abilities as a tactician. And I feel like this book would reward another rereading, because there's the scene where they have Metzoff under Fast Penta, right? Which is their essentially
yes.
flawless truth serum. And he gives up kind of the strategic situation, right? But Miles yeah. immediately says, well, that's what the situation was yesterday. You know, that's as he knew it. So it's going to have changed since then. And now I've listened to it once, I've read it once, and I'm still not sure I followed all of his logic. That ended up being right.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
some of what Miles does is guesswork, and some of it, there's guesswork and there's bluff and all of this. And we see his relationship with these other characters that helps bring out this tactical side of him. So, for example, we have Kai Tung, who is a big character in these first few books, who is sort of takes Miles under his wing and is kind of a military tactical genius.
He's the guy who's the fanboy over
Errol Volkosi, his dad. Yes. Yeah. Yes. And provides a great scene at the end of this book where he's like, you know, basically like, oh, I can probably get him to have dinner with you.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. He never finds out the actual relationship, does he?
Not in this one anyways. Okay. But it does provide a sort of delightful, you know, scene with these characters having to Miles having to basically relate to his father well in the persona of Admiral Naismith,
right,
which is utterly delightful.
Yes.
But yeah, there's a lot there are a lot of things going on, as you point out, with the tactical situation shifting and Miles making all these decisions sort of by the seat of his pants.
Right.
I personally, my favorite scene in this book, and I was laughing out loud as I read this, and I turned and narrated it to my fiance, who has also read them, but I was like, I'd forgotten this scene because it's so good, is the ultimate showdown with Cavillo, where she brings Gregor onto the ship, right? So she's got him as a hostage, essentially, but she's kind of allied with him. She wants to marry Gregor and become the Empress.
Right.
She's like really opportunistic. And Miles knows that the only shot he's got here is if he moves first. So of course, when she brings him on, the first thing he does is, you know, aim a gun at Gregor and say, if you come any closer, I'll kill him.
Right.
And this, that Cavillo is just sort of thrown for a loop, right? Because she, that was going to be her move essentially.
Right.
And she, and Miles just stole her thunder.
Yes.
And Gregor, you know, and this is one of the great moments of Gregor, is, you know, immediately twigs to what Miles is doing.
Right.
And basically walks up to him, you know, and like puts him. So he's like, ah, he's not going to do it. Right. Like he won't do it. And so he walks all the way up and like plants his chest in Miles's gun. And then they just close the door.
Yeah.
Right behind him.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's, you know, and to borrow a phrase from another show that I enjoyed, The Middleman, it's sheer elegance in its simplicity.
Yes.
And to me, that's my favorite. Like, even there is a way that that could have been structured that would have felt very anticlimactic. But because of the fact that there is still tension over whether, because he's bluffing, and whether Cavillo will buy the bluff, because if she just decided, you know, never mind, I'm going to shoot Gregor anyways, the whole thing would have fallen apart.
Yeah.
And so there's still plenty of tension building there as we watch this scene fold out, even though the ending has kind of an almost comical aspect to it.
Well, it all turned too on his understanding of Gregor and,
right,
and thinking there's no way Gregor is really under this woman's spell.
Yes, exactly. You know, he is a Vor. He is smart. And as we were talking about at the beginning, you know, a lot of this is realizing that Gregor is, yeah, as much as he might be weighed down by the responsibility of this life that he has taken on, he is actually incredibly good at it. He's
right.
Very capable. He is discovering that the skills that he has built up, because he has been essentially the emperor since he was a child,
right,
and has been tutored and brought up in this way of life, he has all the necessary skills to deal with a situation like this, to talk himself out of it, to use diplomacy and tact, and to recognize when people are flattering him and trying to take advantage of him. It all makes perfect sense that he would know all these things. He's been surrounded by them for his entire life.
Yeah.
And so that to me is a great moment for Gregor. And really, you know, it sets him on a nice path. Like in later books, you really see him sort of further grow into that role to the point where he becomes, you know, not just the emperor in name, but really does become the best man for the job, essentially.
Right.
And that's another nice, you know, parallel between him and Miles finding their places.
Yeah. It's cool that this book, you know, Miles is definitely the main character. There's no question about that, but I do appreciate that it wasn't just all about him, right? You got that good character development from Gregor as well.
Yeah. You get him, you get the, a lot of the side, characters with the Dendari fleet, even some of the sort of villains, right? You have Admiral Oser, who is kind of taken over the fleet in his absence and isn't really that capable. But he's got his uses, right? Like he's supposedly very good at administrative and logistics. And that's how he kind of outmaneuvers our friend, Mr. Tung, because he's the military genius, but all of a sudden he realizes he's tied to the pocketbook. and this guy controls the pocketbook. And so, you know, again, another great example of showing how characters who are really strong in one dimension don't always have all those skills. Right. And so when they find themselves dealing with something that's a little bit out of their wheelhouse, they can often be at a major disadvantage.
Yeah. Well, why don't we go ahead and wind down here? Just final thoughts on the book.
This is, I think, man, it's, you know, I it's hard for me to pick favorites. I put this one pretty high on the list. It's definitely it and The Warrior's Apprentice are kind of always make a nice twofer for me. Mm-hmm. I think they're, you know, they're written very close together. I think they feel very much of a piece. Mm. In the way that some of the later books kind of diverge and go off into sort of different areas.
Yeah, my library had an omnibus of it just called Young Miles that was the two together. Yeah, and then it had the Mountains of Morning in there, I think.
Oh, okay, good. Which is another good one to put in with that one. And some of the later books, I think there are some other ones that work nicely as sort of a pairs, Brother in Arms and Mirror Dance kind of work as sort of a duology in that sense in the same way. And so for me, this is fun because seeing Miles in sort of the height of his youth, in the height of his like powers, almost as it were, sure. Just sort of, it's a great opportunity to lean back and just ride the whirlwind.
Yes,
because it's a book that is just a nonstop, adventure from start to finish. Like I said, I read it in a few days, and even though I've read it before, and I just sort of devoured it. Mm-hmm. And I think it manages to walk that line between, it's not like a humor book in the sense that, like, you know, your Douglas Adams or your Terry Pratchett, mm-hmm. like wacky joke a minute, but it's fun and it's lighthearted without being, silly or ridiculous. And that's hard. That's not an easy thing to do.
Right. Yeah. And like I said before, I mean, it kept me guessing because I was just sure when they found the body at Curl Island that there was going to be a mystery there. That's what this book was going to be about, you know? And then they wrap it up. It's just a guy who was hiding pastries.
Yeah. Right. Yes, that's right. Okay. Yeah. In the culvert. Yeah, sure. It makes perfect sense.
And the medical examiner's like, yes, like I said, death by stupidity.
Yeah. Yeah. So that I everything does take these bizarre turns, but it manages to still feel very believable and very plausible as we go.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Well, like I said, my library has a bunch of these on audio. And so I do want to get a firm recommendation from you on what book I should read next.
Well, I mean, I'm a completionist, so I would say if you're determined to read some more, the next one is Setaganda. Which is pretty good, but it's a little bit more of it's a little departure because rather than being sort of this galaxy spanning one, it involves a more of a murder plot. And then I will highly recommend to everybody out there. There are a variety of sources where you can find this online, including I think Wikipedia. At the back of some of Bujold's books too, there's sort of a recommended reading order.
Yeah, I think there was one of those in the back of mine. I just kind of wanted an insider perspective.
Yeah, yeah. I tend to go in order because the characters do age and learn as they go. And so I think that it kind of continually builds on itself. And there are certain things that become important, like that you don't want to read certain books in front of other books because they depend so heavily on events that happen. Setaganda, and I think that's the main one that's sort of it's a good book, but it's not as critical to some of the later books. Once you start getting into, like, I believe Brother in Arms, which is the one after that, stuff starts to build a lot more on all the previous books, and it's important to sort of go more in order. And then the compounding trick to that is there are short stories that go in between some of them, of which I will particularly recommend this is a little confusing, but there is a novella / short story called The Borders of Infinity.
Right. I've heard of this.
Yeah. But it's also in a collection in some cases called The Borders of Infinity, which has its own framing story. And it's like, oh, this just is kind of a mess.
Yeah.
But those are kind of interspersed as you go along, and each of them involve The Borders of Infinity, by the way, as a novella / short story, is utterly fabulous and my favorite short story in this entire universe.
And I highly recommend that, and probably best to read that before Brothers in Arms. Okay. And then you can kind of roll through there, through most of the rest of the novels. My other favorite, I would say, which is later on in the series, is A Civil Campaign, which is essentially a comedy of manners with a little bit of intrigue thrown in. And it is another laugh out loud, funny book, with Miles at his best. So that it's worth working your way down to that one.
Okay. Well, I'm definitely encouraged to read further. So
good, good. I'm always happy to bring someone else into the Vorkosigan saga. If that is the most I achieve in life, I feel like I will have done well.
Yeah. It's funny, 'cause after Jason mentioned that on the Slack, then I kept hearing you on various book club podcasts and things talk about it. And so I thought, all right, I get the point.
I probably won't shut up about it. That's the real problem.
No, that's a good thing.
I even lost my voice and I would come on and talk about this.
Definitely. Yes. Yeah. A little bassier today than usual. Well, we already talked about, the Caledonian Gambit. We talked about what was it? The
Beieren Agenda.
Okay. Sounds a little bit like a Robert Ludlum book.
Yeah, you know, that's funny that you say that, because there were different titles when I was working on the Caledonian Gambit, and my editor didn't care for the working title I had been using. And he suggested I spend some time brainstorming new titles. And my fiance or then girlfriend and I were basically like on vacation for a weekend. And I just started like, let's brainstorm some titles. And I kept thinking, oh, these are my titles, you know, as if written by various authors. And the Caledonian Gambit was my Robert Ludlum style title.
Awesome.
And now I've found myself locked into the adjective noun for probably the rest of my career.
Very nice. Yeah.
So I'll take it.
Well, cool. I'm looking forward to that one coming out.
Thank you.
So, and that's March, right?
It's March. Yep.
Excellent. Perfect. We'll be looking for that. Well, where can people find you, Dan?
Any number of places. Of course, you can follow me on Twitter at D Morin. I'm also, I guess, now over at Mastodon, if that's a thing, at D Morin at Zeppelin.flights, which is our incomparable Mastodon. of course, on the podcast that I mentioned earlier, Incomparable, Inconceivable, Total Party Kill, Not Playing. Gosh, it's just a whole bunch of podcasts. If you go to my website, dmorin.com, you'll find a full list of my podcasts, where I write my books, etc. It's probably the best, most central resource there.
Perfect. I'll get all those links and put them in the show notes. I have no idea what Mastodon is.
Oh, man. That's a whole separate kettle of fish.
Okay. I will look that one up on my own time. Well, Dan, I really want to thank you for doing this. I appreciate it. I know you're busy, and I'm glad we got to do this.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Yes. You have won a new acolyte into the religion of Vorkosigan.
Fabulous.
Perfect. All right. Well, maybe we'll talk about another one sometime down the line.
Yeah, hit me up. I'm always happy to talk about Vorkosigan novels or any other Hugo novels. Just let me know.
Perfect. All right. I'll talk to you later.
Ciao.
Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Dan, and I definitely encourage you to check out his stuff. Make sure you check out The Caledonian Gambit. I think it's a very entertaining book. And also check out the rest of the links that I'll put in the show notes to all of Dan's social media. So I want to thank you for listening, and I would invite you to leave us a review wherever you listen to us, and feel free to reach out on social media. I'm at Hugo's Podcast on Twitter and facebook.com/Hugo's Podcast. If you would like to shoot me an email, you can do that, feedback@hugospodcast.com, or go to the website and fill out the contact form there. Any of those ways would be great. And I think that's going to wrap it up for this time. So thank you so much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Cuskey.